You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Now, Don, I was had an indirect interest in a book I was given called Chance. It's about horse racing and gambling, and it's written by one of the great crime writers and journalists, Andrew Rule. And
Wordsmith, can we put Wordsmith in there?
We can certainly put Wordsmith in there. And I have an indirect interest in this because the bloke I play golf with, a man called Stephen Kane, he inspired Andrew, I think, to write this. We've got Andrew on the line. I'm going to read out the back jacket of this book, and this will put in context what it's about. I'm not a racing man. I don't go to the races, but I've read this book. There is so much in it. We're going to get Andrew probably to carry this interview and to give us some insights into what this book's about. But I was fascinated by it. For a man who's not into racing, I was really entertained by it. Don't read many books. And this is what the back jacket says, and this will introduce it. This is the great Les Carline says this for a start. If you want to bet on numbers, go to a casino. If you want theatre, go to the races. And this is what the back jacket says. All his life, Andrew Rule has watched racing's heroes and villains, dreamers and schemers. In Chance, he details the daring, the desperation and the danger of the track, peeling back some of racing's most famous and infamous moments, its celebrations and its secrets, the grittiness behind the glitz. There are stories of those who set the odds and those who take them, betting plunges planned more carefully than bank robberies, of tricky trainers, reckless jockeys and bold bookmakers. Tough at times, tender, dark and sometimes funny, Chance transcends the industry they call the sport of kings. So on the line from his country residence, we have Andrew Rule, and it's great for you to join us, Andrew. This is the second time you've been on our podcast. You can't be serious, and we thank you for joining us. Now, first of all, I want to just ask you, my friend, yes, Stephen Kane, who yep, I think commissioned you to write this book, why did he get you to do it? And then I'd like to speak to you about some of the personalities and dramas of what this book's about, please.
I never knew Steve Kane before. I got a phone call one day from a young fellow called Matthew Tripp. You might have heard of him.
Yes, Matthew Tripp.
Matthew Tripp rang me and he said...
Owns the Storm.
Yes, he's the man. He owns a few things around the place. And I know Matthew a little bit, and I know several of his relatives quite well. And he said, look, I've got a friend called Steve Kane. He's going to ring you. He's not a nuisance. He's not a pest. He's fair dinkum. And he wants to talk to you about writing a book. So I said, no worries. So Steve Kane rings me. And it turns out Steve Kane is the son of Ron Kane, who was a good bookie for many, many years, and grandson of a fellow called Norm Kane, or Snowy Kane, who was a real good bookie from about the 1930s onwards. He was an SP back in the old days when he worked in a boot factory in Fitzroy, and then he moved up the scale until he became a very prominent and pretty successful bookie for a long time. And Steve's the grandson of old Norm. He's not a bookie himself, but he went into business, into the share market and all that sort of thing. And he said that he used the mental maths that his father taught him, Ron taught him, how to calculate odds quickly. And he used it in the stock market in Hong Kong to great effect. And it made him a very successful operator in the stock market. And although he hadn't worked in racing, he'd grown up with that sort of romance of the track and the numbers and the plunges and the winners and losers. And he wanted to do something to capture it before it was all gone. And that's why he was coming to me to write the story.
Well, it is extremely well written, the book, Andrew. I have no problem in saying that. And from what I gather from the book, as I say, not being a racing man myself, but it seems to be racing. It seems to be generally a contest between punters in the know, trainers and jockeys, to manipulate a plunge by stealth or secrecy regarding horses and the credentials of the people that do it. It just is a fascinating insight. What are some of the major or more prominent scams that are illustrated in the book that people would be fascinated by?
Well, it's not a crime book, and yet inside the 20-something stories, there's probably 23 stories in it.
Yeah,
there's at least half a dozen that are pretty crimey, including a very bleak story about the death of a trainer called George Brown, which is a very bad story about a man that was tortured and murdered up in out of Sydney years ago. And that's, you know, it's all to do with race fixing, and it's a very bad story. But the ones that I think most people find appealing are where the punting trainer fraternity put it over the bookies, by and large. And sometimes the bookies do it to themselves. You know, they all sort of prey on each other. And there's a couple of big plunge stories in this book, and one is the story of Torbeck, a horse that... That's all right. That little bit of daddy cool.
It's all right.
Torbeck started life in New Zealand under the name Shady Deal. He'd been bought for sort of nothing by a bloke called Alan Jones, great horse trainer. Was secretly trialled for a long time until they reckon he was about the best maiden, that is, the best horse that had never
had a race. Did you just say Torbeck?
Torbeck.
Andrew, before you go on, I've got the index, and I'm showing this to Don. The only name I've written down there, this is like a sort of a magician's thing. The only name I've got written next to a nice price or shady deal is Torbeck. Isn't that extraordinary? That's the only thing I've written in this book, and you've just mentioned it first up.
Well, I think it's a good yarn. And look, the story of how they took a little horse from New Zealand called Shady Deal, as he was called, beautifully named, actually, and they brought him to Australia knowing that he was the best unraced horse in you know, the Dominions, let's say, in the Southern Hemisphere.
And he was very light.
He was very light. He weighed about as much as a couple of decent ruckmen.
That's right.
He was probably...
350K.
The bloke that trained him claimed he weighed 350K, which is... sort of hard to believe, but he said he was about as wide as your hand. And if he tried to fatten him up, he couldn't gallop. So that's there right. You go. And he gets this, they get the horse out here and they rename it. You can rename horses that come in from New Zealand. Many of them have to be because the names have been duplicated. So they renamed him very cunningly Torbeck because there was a very slow brown gelding going around at that stage called Torbeck, with an R in the middle, Torbeck. And they said, we're going to give him a very similar name to that horse and hope the punters don't pick the difference. Okay. And that's what they did. They give him to a small trainer at Bendigo, a bloke called Barry Fordry. His name goes in as Barry Fordry training him. But in fact, the truck that picks him up from the airport does not take him to Bendigo. It takes him to Wayne Walters, cunning Kiwi trainer.
I knew.
You knew. It was Wayne Walters. Yeah. And Wayne Walters trains his horse in secret, and it's so secret that even his own brother, Graham Walters, the jumping jockey, doesn't realise what's going on. On the day of the race, they've set up a race at Seymour. It's the same day as a big race meeting at Canterbury in Sydney, which is very important for a plunge. You need to be able to get on. They need interstate bookies who will bet. Barry Fordry drives down from Bendigo, the notional trainer. He drives his float into Walter's yard, loads the horse up, and then drives it 350 metres, you know, around the corner to the Seymour racetrack, unloads it, saddles it, all the rest of it. Meanwhile, these blokes have flown to the punters behind this, who are some very cagey customers, Barry Long and the Jorgensen twins and their friends and relatives and all the rest of it. They've flown to Sydney and other places, and they've orchestrated this betting plunge. And they took a fantastic amount of money out of the ring. This is, what, 1981 or something? That's a long time ago. It was about the year that I paid $28,000 for a house.
Yeah.
And these blokes have won, you know, half a million or something, like a lot of dough. So it's... it got them rolling, and it wasn't the first time. Sorry, it was the first time, but after that, they bet on this horse several times, and he kept winning. He was a crackerjack little horse.
Wayne Walters got into a lot of trouble over that, didn't he?
I think the stewards took the view that he'd been less than frank. I don't know that they broke any laws, but the police raided Barry Fordry's stable next morning at dawn at Bendigo because they thought it was a ring-in or something, which it wasn't. It wasn't a ring-in. And the beautiful thing was they'd sent Torbeck up to Bendigo to where he should have been at midnight. An old trotting trainer who's still alive, I think, he towed him up there at midnight, put him in Fordry's stable at Bendigo. And when the police and the stewards raided the joint next morning, there he was.
That's right. I remember
a beautiful, beautiful thing. Beautiful
thing. What got my interest right in the opening sentence of the book at Pistols at Dawn was the name Floyd Podgornick. I bought Floyd Podgornick's house in Brighton 20 years ago. That's what got my attention with Floyd Podgornick. And I noticed that's what got me interested right from the opening sentence of this book. And as I say, it was a fascinating, fascinating read. What Floyd Podgornick, he was a construction magnate, and he committed suicide, I think, didn't he?
He did.
What was his involvement in all this?
Wasn't Mick Price his private trainer?
I did have the odd private trainer. There was one whose name, another guy that used to work for Jeff Murphy, trained for him for a while, Peter Klein, I think, for a while. But Mick Price may well have trained for him. And I think one of the freedmen trained for him at one point. But he was a very big racing man. As you know, he made a lot of money in construction during the boom.
Yep.
And it all went sour for him post-1987, as it went for everybody. His very good mate, Charlie Mantello, jumped out of a building in St Kilda Road. And within days, Floyd shot himself in a penthouse on St Kilda Road because the whole industry turned upside down. And he could see that he was going to go broke, and I don't think he fancied sort of starting again. The humiliation of it, all the rest of it. But he had why I started the book with this story is there's a saying in racing that no one with a stable full of unraced two-year-olds ever committed suicide because, you know, you live in hope. Well, Floyd did. He did have a stable full of unraced horses, and he did commit suicide, but it wasn't the horses that drove him to it. It was the construction industry. And the sort of bittersweet story is that after Floyd's death, his horses started to win. And, several of them won, including a horse called Centro that won a Guineas, which was a big race that turns, you know, colts into millionaire stallions. And he ran second in the Derby. So had Floyd stayed around that year, he would have taken great pleasure in winning a lot of races, including some very big ones.
Now,
that's sad story. Yep.
Andrew, I know the last time we spoke, we have to be careful about who we mention and under what circumstances, because we don't like to edit this. But I think it's all right to speak about people who are no longer with us. I've got a feeling maybe it is or not.
Yep.
But one of the career shysters who interested, I think we can say this, Don. can I mention this man's name who is no longer with us? He was a colourful figure called Rick Renzella. Am I allowed to?
Rick Renzella, no problem. Dead as a doornail. And in any case, has no reputation to defend. You can say whatever you like.
That's right. So I was particularly fascinated by a man who said, I think he was a used car salesman, not that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
But he set out to really completely corrupt the whole industry by whatever means he could. And I was fascinated by some of his scams and schemes.
Rick Renzella. I once swapped a car with him when I was a young fella. I took a car there that didn't have a clutch working. I drove it about 80 kilometres without a clutch, which is pretty tricky. It had a caved-in left-hand door. I parked it. I stalled it to stop it over against the fence so he couldn't see the left-hand side of it. And I swapped him for an old Valiant Ute. And I don't know who got the worst of the deal. We both robbed each other. But he was... He was a shocker. He ran a stolen car racket. He was just a career crook. But he was very smart and cunning. Shocking gambler, you know, couldn't help himself. Died broke, as they tend to do. But he was the man behind the big, notorious ring-in back in the 70s. When I was still at school, I remember it clearly. It was Royal School and Regal Vista down at Casterton. And this, this was when his scam came unstuck and he was caught. He ended up doing jail for it, as the guys with him, the jockey and the strapper and all the rest of it, they all got rubbed out by the racing authorities for their part in it. And Renzella, you know, it was a massive fraud. And the interesting thing, which I heard as a kid from my relatives who were racing people, and it's true what I heard, he had pulled off several of these rorts and got away with it before he came unstuck. So Regal Vista and Royal School was just the one where he came a gutter. Before that, he'd pulled half a dozen of them.
Did he, it's just the same manner, have I got these stories mixed up, did he change the appearance of the horse by putting different marks on them and dyeing their... Is that him?
That's the fine cotton ring in.
Hayden Latana.
Yeah. Oh, that wasn't Mr. Renzella.
Different ring in. But again, Sam, what we remember is when they come unstuck, they get big publicity. What people tend to overlook, including the authorities, because they don't want to look too hard, is that probably they've got away with quite a few before that.
Yeah.
And that's... there's no doubt they were pulling rorts in Queensland for a fair while before fine cotton.
Andrew, what's your passion? Is it crime or racing?
Well, look, there's a little bit of overlap. I don't want to be putting the knock on racing. As I say, the title of this book is The Grit and Gamblers and the Romance of the Racing Life. It's not a crime book. To be accurate, I probably should have said of grit and greed and gamblers. You know, there's greed in it. You know, no doubt about it. And I just thought maybe the publishers wouldn't like the word greed on the cover, but that would be more accurate.
How do you research? It is an extraordinary compendium of stories and facts. How do you research into this? You must have tremendous contacts.
I'd have a few. When I was a kid, I lived in the bush and I had to go away to school to get to high school. And my parents didn't have a lot of dough in the drought years and all that. And I ended up living with an uncle and aunt at a little place called Stratford in East Gippsland, where so I could get on the bus and go to school at Sale. And they were racing people, my cousin. They were racing people and very good horsemen. And I was at an impressionable age. I was 14 or 15, and I rode a bit of work, rode exercise on racehorses, and I was sort of a competent rider without...
Yeah, but you rode in bush races.
I rode in bush races.
Or picnics.
I wasn't like they were. They were hugely competent horsemen in every respect. My cousin John rode in the Grand National, hurdle, and, they were very good horsemen. But apart from being good horsemen, they were great storytellers. They collected stories, they knew stories, and they told them. And I soaked these stories up. And to answer your question, Sam, that's when I really started collecting stories, back 50 years ago when I was a kid in Gippsland. And they sort of infected me with the idea that racing was full of interesting stories and interesting people and rogues and saints and sinners, And I sort of started gathering those things then, and some of the stories they told me have seeped through, and they're in this book. Some of the characters are in this book, because this book's really about stories that have happened probably mainly post, between the war and and the year 2000, probably mostly.
Listen, there's a lot of, and you probably write a sequel to this, Andrew, but do you think that racing has become sanitised now?
It has, for the good reason that it can't, I don't think it can sort of be that really raffish knockabout game that it used to be. It's always had the tendency to be, where there's money to be won, you'll always get humans that will try and tilt the odds their way. And anybody that thinks racing's getting, you know, less honest is crazy. It's far more honest than it ever was in the old days. Can you imagine what it was like back in the days, you know, before they had DNA testing and all that sort of stuff? They did unbelievable things in the real old days.
So another thing that fascinated me, which I would never have thought of because I'm not into it and I'm a bit naive, I don't know if this was Rick Redzeller, but there was a horse called, I think, Coda Penn. Is that?
Yes. And Coda Penn was Renzeller's, you're right.
And he, I'm not sure, you'll correct me if this is wrong, he changed it or its appearance so much that he was so obvious that it was going to win that he didn't back it to win, he backed it for a place. And
you're right.
Put thousands of dollars on it just to win a place. Didn't even back it to the win because he thought that would be obvious if there's any validity to that?
Yeah. Look, he's a very smart cookie, Renzeller, he was. And what he did at one point, he knew Coda Penn was a city class horse. He could win in town. He was a dark brown or black horse, so they tend to look a bit like other dark brown or black horses, you know, because you haven't got really shades of, you know, chestnuts range, as Don knows, a chestnut ranges from very pale washy colour right through to a deep liver colour. But a black horse is a black horse pretty well. So Renzeller had a collection of these black horses that were bred much the same way. They were by the same sire and they looked like each other. And Coda Penn was the good one and the others were slow ones. And what he'd do is get old Coda in and run him under the slow one's names. And what he did, I think, at Moonee Valley on this particular day was back, I forget the name of the slow one, but whichever. Call it King Rabbit. We'll just make it up. Yeah. And he backs King Rabbit for a fortune, and he backed it. What he did, he backed it. I think he backed it each way. He tore up some of them. He was willing to tear up some money. He backed it each way, and then he deliberately got it to run third. He said to the jockey, you could win this, but don't win it, run third. And he took enough out of the pool, because the horse was, you know, 90-1 or something. So he took enough place money out of the pool to be well worth the... So he might have invested 10 grand on this, but he took home, you know, 60 or whatever.
That fascinated me, just to back it for a place, even though he knew it was going to win, or he could have won. Yeah.
Or could have won. And he did what he did also at Bendigo and other places, he'd win, but he wouldn't back his horse on the track. He wouldn't. No money would get to the track for it, and therefore it would stay long odds. And what he'd do is he'd have guys working for him going to TABs, taking doubles, and they'd take his horse, you know, the Coda Penn ring in, King Rabbit, whatever it was, a horse called Brianda Hall, actually was one of them, and they'd take Brianda Hall in one leg of he'd have to run it in one leg of the TAB daily double, and he knew it would win because it was a lot better than the other donkeys in that race. And he'd take it one out in that leg, and then he'd take the field in the other leg. And the field, you know, means every horse in the race, as you probably know, which means that no matter what wins the other leg of the race, he gets a result. And so he would back it all around Victoria in TABs, but not on the track.
I know.
And he would only take doubles. And so when it won, everybody just said, oh, that's funny, that 40-1 shot won. But they didn't take any notice because no one had backed it, apparently. But the double result was huge.
Now, you have a fleeting passing mention of Les. I know, I've heard of Les Samba, who was shot apparently in Middle Park or in Beaconsfield
near where you are.
Yeah, so, I noticed you mentioned Bill Waterhouse. Are we allowed to? Can we chat about
only Bill?
Only Bill.
Only Bill.
We can chat about Bill, can we? We can't.
Yeah,
chat
but not
about why Samba was shot or anything.
But I wouldn't talk about any of Bill's relatives.
No, I know. No. I think that's where we. unstuck the last time. Yeah, so what are those people? Are they colourful identities, as we say, in the industry?
Oh, were? Yes. Well, all right. Well, Bill was a villain in every way. Bill was, you know, a sociopath.
A professional nobbler.
He was a huge bookmaker, but he wanted to tilt the odds his way and cheat. And so he organised for, you know, crooks, including a bloke called Bertie Kidd, who was a gunman and a very dangerous crook, to get teams of guys, and they were fence jumpers, as they call them, to nobble horses. So they'd say, this thing's a favourite at, you know, Randwick or whatever. We can get into that stable at 3 o'clock in the morning before the staffers turn up, and we can hit it up with this or that, some drug. And then it won't win at the favourite. It's favourite for the big race. It won't win, and everything that's bet on it will keep. And we can also back ourselves the other better chances in the race, which they would do. So they'd win coming and going. You know, they'd win with the money in the bag, but they'd also back other things and win from other bookies. So Bill organised this in the 1969 Melbourne Cup. He arranged for a no good strapper to nobble Big Falou. Or the strapper came to him with the offer, but it doesn't matter which. But he paid him to nobble Big Falou, who was the favourite for the cup and would have won the cup by 3 lengths. He was just a terrific horse. It's like Incentivised this year. This horse Incentivised?
Yes.
It'd be like nobbling it. That's how good it was.
Now, Andrew, I've never heard of any of these people, but this fascinated me too. I have a man called John Seaton.
Yeah. The Blue Magic story.
Yes, the Blue Magic. I've got John Seaton written opposite Blue Magic chapter here. Yep. He also, I think, committed suicide in New Zealand, did he?
It tells you something about the highs and lows of racing.
And now, he was a very prominent. Was he in harness racing? Was he or not?
Huge in harness racing.
And what was his quickly? What was his story? Why did he commit suicide? And why was he so well known? Was he a scammer?
John Seaton, he was a self-made millionaire made in the meat business over there. He became the biggest trotting owner, I think, of the South Island, if not all of New Zealand, and he was. Got tied up in a scam. There was a fellow Kiwi, a bit of a low-rent geezer, con man called Asquith, who sold stuff called Blue Magic. And Blue Magic is a drug. It's a slang name for a real drug. And the drug is used to enable people to breathe more easily. It expands your vascular veins and all your organs. So you breathe more easily if you've got asthma or something like that. And this stuff has an effect on racehorses. It allows them to breathe more easily and to win, particularly races that require stamina, right? Not so much sprinters. Very suitable for trotters. And this bloke was selling this stuff first in
like
Australia.
Like Ventolin.
Something like that, yeah. But when you apply it to horses, it has this effect. So he sells this stuff in Australia. Interestingly, he lived at Ballarat, opposite the racecourse, which is the interesting thing, for a while, this fella Asquith, and then he went home to New Zealand when it got too hot for him here. And Seaton got mixed up with him, and it all came unstuck. The stewards swooped, and they booked Seaton's horses and said, you know, you've been using this stuff, and they charged him. And Seaton was humiliated because he was a wealthy man in Christchurch, and he was very, very ashamed and upset and angry. And he really went off. He sort of went off. He's gone. He should have just, I don't know, not worried about it. But, I mean, you get rubbed out of harness racing, it's not the end of the world. And he went home and shot himself with the pea rifle behind the door, you know, that he kept for the possums.
Well,
and Asquith, the bloke that supplied the stuff, he hanged himself off the road.
Well, now, Andrew, This, as I say, I won't keep it, well, we'll repeat this. I've found that a fascinating book for a man who's not interested in, really in the sport at all, and it's extremely well written. It's called Chance, and this will be the this will show you how much I know about the whole thing. So this will be the most naive question you've ever been asked, but I was fascinated by you say, particularly Renzella's horses, they were he had black horses, and he said black horses are, you or he or you say, black horses are rare. They're not like the dark horses or the greys or the chestnuts. It is a black horse. Is there a difference? Is it do different coloured horses run better or are bred better than, or is that just nonsense?
Well, not really. So, look, some people have those prejudices. As Don would tell you,
chestnut horses, you never trust chestnut horses like red-headed men or people, aren't they? They're always a little bit screwy.
A bit toey, look, and a lot of...
So there is something in the colour of a horse.
Well, it might be. There might be. And the Arabs, look, there's always been legends. They say the Arabs think that the bay horse will go harder and longer than others, you know. It's, I don't know what truth there is in these things, because people bag, you know, washy chestnuts, and then you say, well, what about Hallmark, who was the greatest horse of the 30s apart from Farlap, and they were both light chestnuts, you know. A Secretariat, probably maybe the greatest horse the world's seen as a galloper, was a chestnut. So, you know, you can argue for or against any proposition on colour, size or looks. As Don knows, you know, you can just pick an example to prove any case.
Well,
or unproven.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. I tell you, if I could ever recommend anything, which the people would shy away of anything I recommend, but Chance is a fantastic book about all the things we've mentioned, written by one of the great journalists. And
is there going to be a sequel, Andrew, or another racing book? Because you're only scratching the surface.
Oh, no. Look, I've been at the siege with people sending me ideas, and Robbie Lang, the trainer, he wrote me, somebody said recently, they said, somebody asked somebody, they said, who's the best trainer some years ago? And they said, well, Mick Price is the best businessman and Robbie Lang's the best horseman, you know. And
Pity Robbie, they can't combine the two.
Well, that's true. Somebody ought to get hold of Robbie and run a stable for him and let him train the horses, because he's bloody good at it. I've got lost there. Just saying,
it's a fantastic book and it's written well, and you're not just relegated or you write crime and you write horse racing, and I even noticed you've written the authorised biography on Kerry Stokes, and you've written about Neville Rann, and are an extraordinary, and as I say, one of the rare people who's appeared twice on our very popular podcast.
Can I ask him a question? I've sat here and listened to you. Andrew, your father's a well-known, what would you call, fence maker.
He was, yes. He did that. He made post and rail fences, split rails, and mortising the posts.
I'm just trying to give a background because it fascinates me. Yep. Where did you get this ability to be able to write the way you do? Now, your father is a real bushman.
He was. Intelligent man who could tell a story. Like a lot of those blokes were. When I was a kid, a lot of the people in the older generation were they're clever people who worked in the bush or on farms or whatever, because that's what they'd been.
Well, what was your mother, a school teacher?
My mother was a school teacher, and she was highly literate. She still is. Very good writer herself. I think she won the writing prize at MLC when she was a girl or something. And she brought us all up to read books and to read prodigiously. And I read at a young age, and I read probably... By the time I was 12, I was reading sort of adult fiction and stuff like that. Now, you know, I was reading pretty good books as a kid. And I read a hell of a lot. And I think, you know, we lived out in the bush and we didn't really have television, or the reception was bad. Radio reception was bad. And books were your only escape from the daily life. And the daily life involved mucking around with, you know, horses and ponies and sheep and cattle and all the rest of it. So... that's where it comes from, that combination of things.
And if everyone wanted to buy the book, Chance, I'm just looking on the Google machine here, and there's about 83 different prices because you can buy it audio books, and so I'm not about to say how much it costs. It ranges from, I'm not sure why it ranges, but it's buy it from where can you get it, Chance?
Well, all good bookshops, many bad bookshops as well, and online. Sales are, I don't know why they're so cheap. I don't understand how Amazon and all them do it. I think that they're lost leaders. They basically don't make anything on them.
That's right. It ranges from $39.95 down to $22. I'm not sure how you justify any of those price differences, but that would be because probably you don't own a bookstore and don't have to pay rent or something. I don't know.
That's very true. And look, if I was urging people, I'd say go to your local bookshop and support them because, you don't want them to die out. And the really good shops like the one near you, Sam, in Albert Park.
Yes.
There, is it called the
very good bookstore?
Yeah, he's a beauty, that one. And I like to support bookshops myself, but I don't mind how people buy it. I'd like them to buy one and not lend it.
That's it. That's a very good point. Now, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us, and I would encourage people to buy a chance. And I can now speak to Stephen Kane about a little bit more intellectually about it all, seeing as I've read the book.
Can he play golf?
He's an excellent golfer, a very good amateur golfer.
Oh, okay, right. Oh, well, he's which I'm not, so there you go. But I can spell.
Yes.
Okay.
Good on you. Thank you, mate.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. Bye-bye. See you, Don. Bye.
I'm open around the streets late at night. I'm worried because you ain't treating me right. Come back again. Just crazy about you, baby.